Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's interview. How much is the space on your forehead worth? Would you sell that personal piece of real estate to an advertiser if you were strapped for cash? How about your ability to give birth, or maybe your vital organs? Do we all have a price? Should we pay children to get good grades? Is it ethical to pay people to test new drugs? What about hiring mercenaries to fight our wars? Outsourcing inmates, for-profit prisons, auctioning admission to elite universities, or selling citizenships to immigrants able to pay. Popular Harvard professor Michael Sandel notes that in recent decades, market values have taken over almost every aspect of life. Medicine, education, government, law, art, sports, even family life and personal relations. He argues we've drifted from having a market economy to being a market society. In his new book, What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets, Sandel asks, is there something wrong with a world in which everything is for sale? If so, how can we prevent market values from reaching into spheres of life where they don't belong? And finally, what are the moral limits of markets? Michael Sandel teaches Justice, one of Harvard's most popular courses. When the university made it available to alumni, over 5,000 participants signed up around the world. He's delivered lectures and TV series all over the world. He was featured on the cover of China Newsweek as the most influential foreign figure of the year. Sandel is the author of several books, including Democracy's Discontent, America in Search of a Public Philosophy, Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do, and his newest, What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. Welcome, Michael Sandel.
Thanks, Terrence. Thanks for having me.
Well, you are very welcome. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you briefly talk about your personal path to the work that you're doing today and go back, you know, to childhood, college, if that fits, and feel free to include mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
I actually spent my high school years, Terrence, in Los Angeles.
At Pali High, right?
Pali High. That's where I went to high school.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was the student body president of Pali High in 1971 and invited Ronald Reagan, who was then the governor of California and who lived in the district, to come have a debate with the students and me at Pali High. So I have fond memories of those years.
Well, actually, and you also offered him, I believe, 6 pounds of jelly beans to do so.
That's how I enticed him to come, how I got his attention. He was actually very gracious, and I took a six-pound bag of jelly beans to his home in Pacific Palisades, along with an invitation to come to the school. Most of us did not agree with his political views. Very few people in the school did. But he came, and we had a debate about whether 18-year-olds should be able to vote and about the Vietnam War and the United Nations and Social Security. And it was really quite an experience for, as I was then, a high school senior.
Sure, exactly. And then from high school, you go on to Brandeis, I think?
Yes, I was an undergraduate at Brandeis and then did my graduate work at Oxford in England and then came back, and I've been teaching at Harvard since 1980. I teach political philosophy, and the subject of the book, What Money Can't Buy, is really, it's about the moral limits of markets and the limits of economic thinking. I was always intrigued, first and foremost, by politics, but also I've been struck, since I've begun teaching at least, by the growing role that economic thinking and market values play in our lives. And so this book is an attempt to step back and take a look at the role of market reasoning and market values as economics has really become an imperial discipline, purporting to explain and govern the whole of life. And so I'm trying to help prompt a debate about where markets serve the public good and where they don't belong.
Okay, very good. Let's talk a bit before we get into this book about philosophy, ethics, and academia.
Right.
How do you explain the enormous popularity of your justice classes?
Well, we did an experiment with the course. We made it available not only to alumni, as you mentioned, but we went further and made it Harvard's first course to be made freely available as an open access course online and on public television. What astounded me, this was an experiment, was how viewers abroad took to it, including many in East Asia, in Japan, in Korea, also in Brazil, in India, but especially in China. And what I find is that there's an enormous hunger in the U.S., but especially in some of the societies around the world, an enormous hunger to engage in serious public debate about big questions to do with values, justice, the meaning of citizenship, and the common good. I think that's really the secret to the success. It's that our public life, and the public life of many countries, is really empty of serious debate on big ethical questions about the economy and about how to arrange our political institutions.
We will return, I intend, towards the end of the hour to talk about public debate, because it's interesting, as you're saying at the top of this interview, that the paucity of it, the weakness of it, is what creates the popularity of your course, and yet, to some extent, the solution that you offer for these questions, or at least the path forward for the questions that you raise in the book, is vigorous public debate. So we'll talk about that again at the end. I also want to talk about teaching. Have you seen the current issue of Harvard Magazine, which has an article called Twilight of the Lecture?
I've not seen it,
okay.
But I'm aware of the discussion about whether the lecture is an obsolescent way of delivering learning.
So let me set it up, because I happened to see it this week, and I thought this was so apropos, given I've watched on the Harvard website, there is a video, about a half an hour video, introducing people to the justice course, and the way it does it is by showing your interaction with the students. The article, Twilight of the Lecture, says that the trend of active learning may overthrow the lecture format that has basically ruled universities for 600 years, peer instruction, interactive learning. What's interesting about this is that they've done a lot of testing, and those sorts of learning where the attendees, the students, interact a lot more with each other and with the professor and with the teacher seems to result in much better understanding and retention. Now, do you consider what you do using those methods is the first half of the question. The second part is, what do you see happening in this realm on college campuses?
I think that the opportunity for students to interact, to be active participants in learning, is enormously important. And I suppose that's the second answer to the question you asked me about why the popularity of the course. Actually, listeners to this program can go online and see the entire course, which we made available, including the student interaction. It's on justiceharvard.org. It's entirely free. It's free open access. And what, as you mentioned, the course, it is a kind of lecture I give, but not a standard lecture where I stand up at the podium and talk at the students for an hour or less. I throw out questions, challenges, ethical dilemmas to the students. They respond, even in this big lecture hall, they respond to me. They argue with one another respectfully, but they argue, they participate, they engage. And so we really work together at thinking through some of the hard ethical questions that confront us in public life. And that's been a big part of the success of it. Students love to be involved in their own learning. And since the justice course is about civic questions and ethical dilemmas, it lends itself to discussion, deliberation, argument, back and forth among the students and between the students and me. I also think this is part of what young people in China and elsewhere find so energizing. I think they're somewhat shocked but also exhilarated by the sight of a professor being responded to and argued with in the lecture hall. It's not something that they've encountered in their educational experience. This is true in many of the countries where this has become very popular, where the online lecture series became popular. So I think that's a big part of it, too. They get to see the Harvard students arguing with famous philosophers, arguing with John Stuart Mill and Aristotle and Immanuel Kant, and also arguing with me, their professor. And I think there's something exhilarating in that interaction, that prospect of open argument and debate.
Yeah. One of the things that's mentioned in that article is, I believe it's Professor Mazur in physics. Quite a different thing, you know, in terms of, you know, you get to talk about, you know, these dilemmas, and you always start from the dilemma in daily life and then kind of work backwards to the classical philosophers. But he found that if he has students who think they understand the physics problem, pair up and try to convince each other of their solutions, that the correct solution almost always wins, and that both of them end up learning more and retaining more than if he just tells them and demonstrates, no matter what a wonderful lecture he is. And I think this is a really interesting thing. I'll share with you, Professor Sandel. I do public speaking and training of nonprofits and foundations on communications. And a colleague of mine and I did a survey. And we asked 2,500 folks who work at nonprofits and foundations what they most wanted in presentations, which lectures and classes are, and what they least wanted. And the least is people who read their PowerPoints. That's pretty obvious. But the most was interaction. And so it's both people get it in their gut, and now tests are bearing it out. Let me now ask you about a very specific experience I had. I'm a few years older than you and was actually at Harvard from 65 to 69. And one semester, I think my senior year, I took both John Rawls' course on ethics and Lawrence Kohlberg's course on moral development, which was really an interesting thing to put together. But for my final paper in Rawls' course, I challenged the notion that individuals in the real world engage in the sort of rational decision-making that was emphasized in his course on ethics. And I was teaching secondary school at the time, and I discussed with my students, as well as with some of my friends, and remember, this is 1969, how they actually made decisions. And what I wrote about was that it seemed to me that ethics, as he presented it, all but ignored emotion and impulse and those sorts of things that human beings all felt was a crucial part of their actual decision-making. I took the course pass-fail, and I passed, but I'll never forget the comment that he wrote. John Rawls wrote on my paper, "You may be asking too much of the field of ethics," in quotes. Yeah. Your thoughts about that?
Well, first, I have great respect for John Rawls, who has had an enormous impact for the good, I think, on political philosophy. I do disagree with his way of thinking about justice. He said, and it was a very novel and important contribution, he says the way to think about justice is to try to think about those principles we would agree to govern our collective lives if we agreed behind what he calls a veil of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
If we set aside temporarily everything particular about us, our race, our ethnicity, our class, our gender, our religious views, our moral convictions, and simply try to arrive at principles of justice without reference to those, as he sees them, contingencies. And I've argued for some time that we can't think about justice in that way, and that blocks out morally relevant information about our our traditions, our location in the world, our moral and spiritual values. And this has led to a big debate among political philosophers, and not everybody agrees with me, but the broader issue is whether debates about justice and debates about our public life can be neutral or should try to be neutral with regard to competing visions of the good life. And I say we should not aspire to that kind of neutrality. I say we should welcome moral and spiritual convictions of citizens into the public arena, not try to bracket them out. But as I say, this is a controversial question in political philosophy, and it sounds like you were onto it quite early.
Yeah, I mean, and that, but can you go just one step more with what he said, that that I was asking too much of the field of ethics, that it include those sorts of things? Is that basically that what you're saying in your answer just then, Professor Sandel, is that he was true to his definition? And that once I brought in things like emotions and their social experiences and so on, and as I say, sort of what I might have been calling instinctual impulses and those sorts of things, that's all what he wants to eliminate behind that veil of ignorance.
Yes, I think what he probably meant when he said you were asking too much is, I think, two things. First, I think he believed those considerations are not relevant to questions of justice because they reflect various contingencies of life. And I also think he believed that trying to bring them in would lead to unavoidable conflict and disagreement, and that if we allowed those considerations to enter, we would never agree on principles of justice because we don't agree on those desires and those convictions. And so in a way, this is – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No.
I think that's what he meant in his kind of comment on your paper.
Yeah. So, but my question to you would be, as you view your course on justice, which in some sense is ethics falls within that or parallel with that, ethics and justice?
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you think that your students, in the way that you're approaching it, in the way that they're dealing with it, are able to bring in their emotions, their impulses, their context?
Yes, they bring them in, but it's not enough, we find together, simply to assert emotions and impulses and convictions. Part of what we do is to try to reason together about the moral views and the political ideals that flow from people's emotions, impulses, traditions, convictions, and so on, to reason them through, not just to assert them and to say there's nothing more to be said. And that public reasoning, that moral reasoning, I think is really what we need to engage in public deliberation about the things that matter most. And in a roundabout way, this is connected to the new book, because I think by relying so heavily these days on economic reasoning, we are failing to bring to bear in public life our moral and even spiritual convictions, and that this has led us to a kind of unsatisfying managerial technocratic public discourse where there's a lot of shouting, not much listening, and very little serious public reflection about how to value the various social goods we prize.
Very good. There's a couple of things I'm just going to quote you, actually. You say at the beginning and again at the end of your course on justice that many of the questions you deal with are unanswerable or impossible to answer, but also inescapable, and that we live some version of them every day in our lives. And I think that's a wonderful way to think about it. It's that you are not, someone does not leave your course with the answers. They leave more than anything, I would think, with the experience of wrestling with the questions.
Yes.
Okay. And you also say, the aim of this course is to awaken the restlessness of reason and to see where it might lead. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Michael Sandel about his new book, What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. You can learn more at justiceharvard.org. And there you can actually get access for free to his entire course, one of the most popular courses at Harvard. I want to jump now to, again, this is a little bit contextual for the new book and not right on its point, but with regard to political theory, about which you've written a lot, you said of the liberal communitarian debate that there are two versions. The first, those who place more weight on individual rights, those, and the second, those who place more weight on community. Now, what's your take on that debate? And is that, would you say that is the current debate between left and right in this country, or at least between the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street?
Not really, because there, I've argued in my political theory against thinking about politics in purely individualistic or libertarian terms, and I've argued against thinking about politics in ways that try to be neutral toward values and moral and spiritual convictions. I've argued, and this is why I've been labeled a communitarian, I've argued that we need, when we debate justice or the meaning of the common good, we need to draw upon our moral convictions. And we make a mistake if we assume we can have these debates from a purely individualistic point of view, because that misses the moral ties we have with other members of our community. It misses the sense in which we are already indebted to one another, even before we take up the social contract, even before active choice between consenting adults. So I've been put in the communitarian camp, but what I mean by that is not that individual rights aren't important. They are very important. What I mean is we can't identify and justify individual rights from a purely neutral point of view. We have to reason from some conception of the good life, some conception of civic virtue. And that's why I say we have to bring those moral convictions and conceptions of the good life into politics. It's not enough to try to be neutral toward competing values and purposes and ends.
Very good. Let's now turn to what money can't buy, the moral limits of markets. And here's a two-sentence thing that you say that I want you – I'm going to first give you how someone else responded to it, and then I want you to expand on it. And it's basically this. In a society where – these are your words. In a society where everything is for sale, life is harder for those of modest means. The more money can buy, the more affluence or the lack of it matters. Now, I happen to look up some comments on your work, and a Forbes blogger disagrees, Forbes magazine blogger. He says, having more money, being at the interesting end, as he puts it, of financial inequality, will get you many homes, more expensive food, $1,000 shoes, and so on, but it won't change in any manner your access to the minimum necessary of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And he says financial inequality is less important now than it was because we've much greater consumption equality. And this is that notion that even a poor person now probably has hygiene, probably has indoor plumbing, probably has a refrigerator, probably has a television, probably has a cell phone. And so he says that consumer equality trumps financial inequality. Your response?
Well, my first response is that consumer equality is based on our identity as consumers, and I think that misses what's most important, which and part of my concern is that our identity as consumers in recent decades has been crowding out our identities as our identity as citizens. And so I'm trying to put citizenship back at the center of public debate. And to question our tendency to think of equality and to think of freedom primarily in terms of our consumer identities. The writer you quote, he may be right or she may be right if the reference is to economic advances over the way things were 100 or 200 years ago. But if we look at the past three decades, at the period since, let's say, the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher brought in a kind of market revolution. They argued that markets, not government, were the primary instruments of the public good, And in many ways, even after they passed from the scene, their successors, Tony Blair, Bill Clinton, they moderated that market fate, but didn't fundamentally challenge it. We really haven't had a debate about that idea. And then after the Cold War, there was a sense that capitalism won, and capitalism was only one thing, and it meant markets and market efficiencies should govern the whole of life. It's really that that I'm questioning. And if you look at the growing role of markets since the 80s, markets have reached in to spheres of life, and market values have come to dominate spheres of life well outside consumer goods and material goods.
Yeah, what I'm going to do right now, Michael Sandel, is I'm going to ask you to comment on a few of the kinds of examples that you deal with in the book. For instance, the simple notion of jumping the queue. Of getting ahead in line without waiting in line as long as others might. That you talk about that in a number of spheres. Could you talk about that? It's a good example, a good window into this.
We see it in small spheres at amusement parks. Now you can buy a more expensive ticket and you don't have to wait with your family on the long lines for the popular rides. In airports, those long lines to get through the security checkpoint, the airlines will sell you the right to go to the head of that line, whether you buy a more expensive ticket or even if you don't. They sell line jumping privileges now as an a la carte perk. Now, these are small, ordinary, mundane examples of paying to jump the line. But you see the same thing in bigger, more consequential places. In access to health care, the rise, for example, of concierge or boutique physician practices where you can pay extra for same-day appointments and access to the cell phone number of your doctor. You see it in immigration. One economist, Chicago free market economist, proposed that we simply sell the right to immigrate in this country as a way of deciding who should come. And in a way, we already do that because Congress enacted a law in 1990, I think it was, that said a foreign investor who invests $500,000 and creates 10 American jobs, gets a green card for the family and it can come and live in the United States. So in many ways, over the past three decades, we essentially have allowed in many spheres of life, large and small, we've allowed those who can afford it to pay to jump to the head of the line.
And your thoughts about that. Give us some of the reflections on it, because I know what you do in many of these examples is you look at the justification, then you look at, but is there something left out of the justification? It seems to me in most cases. And what you do is you point to what's left out of the sort of airtight economic justification for these things.
Right. Well, take the example of auctioning off citizenship. Or for that matter, the idea of if a university wanted to auction access, auction off admissions, suppose a parent, an affluent parent, is willing to donate $1 million or $10 million for a new library. Should universities auction access to the freshman class? One objection to enabling people to buy their way to the head of the line is that it's unfair to those who can't afford it. Who can't afford to buy the right to immigrate or to gain a place in a university if it's up for sale. But there's another consideration, and this is really what I focus on in the book and I'm hoping to bring to kind of public attention and debate. Buying and selling certain things can be corrupting of the goods themselves. So, for example, a university that auctioned places in the freshman class at auction admission would corrupt or degrade the meaning and purpose of higher education, auctioning off citizenship to the highest bidder, cheapens citizenship for all of us. You can see this most clearly if you take one of the few things that can't explicitly be bought and sold today, votes. If you take standard economic reasoning, standard economic efficiency arguments, it's hard to explain why there should not be a free market in votes. Half the people don't even use their votes in presidential elections. Why not let them sell their votes to the to people who want to buy them, and we know there will be such people. Why don't we do that? Well, we don't do it because even though it would be economically efficient, these would be voluntary transactions, voluntary exchanges, we believe that the vote is not a piece of private property, but it's properly regarded as a civic duty, as a public responsibility. So what's left out of account, to go back to your question, in all of these questionable cases of commodification, is the meaning of the good, the moral meaning or the civic meaning of the good in question. And what I'm saying is, before we apply standard economic efficiency arguments to extend markets into these spheres, we have to debate what is the meaning of the good in question, and to what extent would that social practice, whether it's immigration or higher education or voting, be corrupted or degraded if we allowed markets to govern?
Yeah, very good. In other words, what the sort of, I would say, the arid sort of economic analysis is all about social utility and efficiency. And what you're saying is, wait a minute, if there's something else that you're leaving out of that, that may not be the full picture. What about naming rights? What's the sort of the pro and con, if you will, of naming rights?
We've seen a proliferation of naming rights also in the same period, the past three decades. It began in large measure with sports stadia, baseball, football, basketball, arenas and stadiums. Increasingly, during this period, sold the right to corporations to name them. And now that by itself seems innocent enough. The games can proceed. It's more or less unaffected. But it's the naming rights practice has extended even to the broadcast of the games. Because now if you watch a baseball game, for example, and I'm a big baseball fan, the announcers have to incorporate into their account of the game endless corporate-sponsored naming rights moments. So for example, now when the manager replaces the pitcher and calls in a relief pitcher, in many places, contractually, the announcer has to call it an AT&T call to the bullpen.
Right.
In the Arizona ballpark, when it was called Bank One Ballpark when it was built, and the announcers were contractually obligated to call every home run that was hit by the home team a Bank One blast. So even the narrative of the game is transformed and appropriated in a way by corporate naming rights. When a player slides in safely to second base now, when I'm watching the Red Sox games, the announcer has to say, safe at second, safe and secure in New York life.
Yeah, I know I've also heard the Corona timeout is one that we have out here. And also the in and out, I think, is like the change of pitchers is in and out burger. Now, but this is, we're just talking about baseball. Why does that matter?
Well, it matters because it's not restricted to sports. Increasingly, there is such a thing as, they call it municipal marketing, where cities and towns, in order to raise money, to ease the burden on taxpayers, to avoid cutting services, sell naming rights to municipal facilities. We now, in many communities across the country, have advertising on school buses, advertising within schools, on the corridors, in the cafeterias, and even mandatory viewing of commercial-laden news programs in the schools themselves, so that the public schools are being converted, and this is also over this the last three decades, are being converted into places of advertising. And that's corrosive, to get back to what we were discussing before about the corrupting effect sometimes of market intrusion. It's corrosive, I think, of the purpose of the public school, which is not to provide basic training consumers, but instead the purpose of the public schools is to cultivate citizens, capable of reflecting critically.
Right, that informed citizenry in which the informed citizenry that a democracy depends on.
Exactly. And so to drench the school in commercial advertising and in consumerism and to encourage students to use the authority of the school to promulgate consumerist values really is at odds with the proper mission of the public schools, which is to cultivate citizenship and the ability to reflect critically on the world that young people will be entering as citizens. So we also see corporate naming rights in some communities on police cars, and just in Baltimore where they're debating whether to put corporate ads on the fire trucks of the city of Baltimore. In Indianapolis, they put them on fire hydrants. So everywhere the eye can see, including in the civic landscape, increasingly there is an appropriation of the civic landscape and of municipal life by commercial advertising.
And so what the economist might say, again, efficiency, cities and counties are having a tough time now. This is a way to gain. And who's hurt by it? And what you say is that, again, leaves out the question of what a city is and what the commons that we share is.
Exactly. Yes. In any one instance, it could be argued that, look, it raises money for the city or town. It doesn't hurt anyone, certainly not directly. People can avert their eyes if they like. You could make this argument. But taken as a whole, the accumulated effect of extending naming rights to every nook and cranny of municipal space and of civic life is to appropriate the commons and in a way to privatize it. So commercialism writ large in this way corrodes commonality, the sense that we are all in this together and that public spaces are shared spaces accessible to everyone, and it parcels them out and turns them into billboards. And this, I think, corrupts shared civic spaces, which are important to public life.
I don't think we're going to have a chance to talk about it, but I will say that it seems to me, as I certainly agree with you, that this has all grown enormously over the past 30 years. I think, as you point out, there were three stadiums that were named, and now there are in America like 200 or something. But but on the other side, and again, I don't know that we'll have time to talk, there is a movement toward the commons, recognizing the value of the commons. There's commons licensing now where people do that instead of copyright. There's open source technologies where people forego their intellectual property rights to share it. So there seems to be a counter movement. Observe on that briefly, if you will.
Well, I agree. And I think this is a welcome development. And the free open access experiment we did with this, the justice course I teach was one experiment exactly in that direction, simply to make it free and open to anyone, anywhere in the world who wanted to see it or to take the course. And the fact that people are doing this in various areas of intellectual property is a good thing. And I think it's a reaction against the encroachment that people feel and see of commercial values and corporate naming all around us. So I think it's a very encouraging counter trend.
What I found fascinating and encouraging also was that, in fact, some of these things don't even work on economic grounds. In other words, the incentives don't produce the effects that people expect. Could you talk about the Israeli studies on daycare pickups, charitable fundraising, and the Swiss nuclear siting issue?
Right. Standard economic reasoning says, if you put a price on something, people will consume less of it and vice versa. That's the standard economic account. But that's not always the case. In the in Israel, there were daycare centers where they had the familiar problem that parents came late, some did, to pick up their kids, and the teacher had to wait till the late-arriving parents came. So with the help of some economists, they established a fine for late-arriving parents. And what happened, paradoxically, is the number of late arrivals increased rather than decreased. This is a paradox from the standpoint of standard economic reasoning. But if you believe that money and markets and cash incentives or fees change attitudes, change norms, then it's not so surprising. What happened was, before late arriving parents felt guilty. They were imposing on the teachers. Now, they figured they were just paying for a service. It was like a babysitting service.
Right, right.
So they could arrive later. And so the monetary fine, they treated as a fee, and it crowded out their sense of responsibility. And we see this in other cases. You mentioned another one that I have in the book, which is the Swiss nuclear waste site, where in Switzerland they had to locate nuclear waste sites somewhere. They asked citizens at the time, would you accept it here? Now, no one likes it in their backyard, but 51% said yes. Then they asked them, suppose the government pays each citizen up to $8,000 a year in compensation, then would you accept it? You'd think that the acceptance rate would go up on standard economic reasoning. But it dropped by half, from 51% to 25%.
That's significant. It drops by half. So I thought it was a good, I was willing to do it. Now you're giving me 8,000, and yet one out of every four surveyed has changed their mind against it.
They said we didn't want to be bribed. And here again, it shows that sometimes a cash incentive changes the meaning before they were willing to do it out of a sense of civic virtue or public responsibility. The country needs this. Ours is the safest place to bury the stuff, so we will accept it despite the risk. But now we're being paid. It's a financial transaction. No, thank you very much. We'll do without it. And so these are examples of the way in which once money and markets reach into spheres of life governed by non-market values, like a concern for civic virtue or a sense of not wanting to impose on the teachers in the daycare case, markets, the economists often assume that markets don't change the goods they exchange. But that's not always true. Sometimes markets crowd out, or monetary payments or cash incentives crowd out non-market values and attitudes and norms worth caring about. And that's why I think we need to have a public debate case by case about where markets belong and where they don't, where they may produce efficiency but might also corrupt or corrode or crowd out important values worth preserving.
Well, I think what's wonderful about, and let me just throw in two other examples you have in the book. One is that, again, it was Israel. It was teenagers collecting door-to-door for charity.
Right.
And they had three groups. One group got nothing, got no specific reward, financial reward for doing so. One got to keep 1% of what they collected, I think, and the other one got to keep 10%. Well, it turned out the folks who got to keep 10% collected more than the folks who got to keep 1%, but they both collected less than the people who got nothing. And so,
right.
Again, it's your thing of the ones who were doing it out of the feeling of charity actually worked harder, went at it longer, and so on. Now, what? And the one other one was AARP asked lawyers if they would do some work for senior citizens for $30 an hour, and they said no. And they said, would you do it for free? And they said yes. And so that tradition of pro bono service speaks to a charitable giving back to society. Now, what I like about these cases is once you've shown that that there is a corrupting influence, that these things don't go by the equations the economists would say, then it seems to me you've said, so now all those other things you thought were where the market was neutral, they're worth examining because these cases clearly point out that your assumption is flawed.
Exactly. And so when we come, this is another example in the book, you know, a lot of school districts are trying to motivate underachieving students to study and get good grades by paying them for good grades or high test scores, or in Dallas, paying third graders $2 for each book they read. There's a big debate about cash incentives to students, but the worry is, just as you summarize these examples, Terrence, the worry is that even if it worked, and by the way, the results have been very mixed, is there the risk that we would be driving out, failing to teach the real message which is we want students to learn to read and study for the love of learning, not for the sake of a check.
Right. I'm speaking with Michael Sandel about his book, What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets, and you can learn a lot more about his work and actually take his course on justice for free at justiceharvard.org. We've got just a few more minutes. Let's talk about, as I said at the top, you bemoan the sort of the degradation, the weakness of public debate, and attribute some of it, at least some of it, to this notion that markets control everything, and or that we can think about everything as markets. And let me just you have a couple of quotes. I know you've got one from Larry Summers, in which. What is it he says? He says, basically, Kenneth Arrow and Larry Summers both sort of say, we have only so much altruism in us. Economists like me think of altruism as a valuable and rare good that needs conserving. That's a contestable notion, I believe. There are those that would say, I think the positive psychology field that's studied around the country but centered at Penn basically has found that generosity breeds more generosity versus the other way around. But let's talk about your solution, kind of, or at least what you say is necessary, is more of a public debate about this thing that has happened, as you say, kind of without anyone – without us announcing it was a campaign we were going to do, that economics was going to now move into spheres of that it never was into before, and that the, as you say, are we a market economy or a market society? But it's that weak public debate that has allowed us to happen, and yet you say the solution, or at least what's necessary, is more public debate. How is that going to happen?
Well, it's not easy, I should concede that at the outset. But take one more shift that's gone largely unnoticed and undebated. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there were more private military contractors than there were U.S. military troops. We never had a debate about whether we wanted to outsource war to private companies, but we looked up one day, and it had just happened. So what I'm calling for is a morally invigorated kind of public debate. We have sometimes, I think, an allergy to bringing controversial moral questions into politics, partly because we are afraid that there will be disagreement, we'll never be able to agree, but also because I think we are in the grip of market thinking. And one of the appeals of trying to solve social problems with markets and economic incentives is that markets seem non-judgmental. They seem value neutral. They seem simply to take people's preferences as they come and to try to maximize them or to allocate them efficiently. But I think that's a mistake, and it's wrought all of the questionable uses of markets that we've been discussing, Terrence. So what I think we need to do is to have a morally more robust kind of public discourse. We sometimes think of morality and talk of values and virtues in politics as the sole province of cultural conservatives, as when they talk about abortion and when they oppose same-sex marriage. But I think we should try to broaden what it means to bring moral argument into politics and address the big questions about the economy and about the role of markets. Because if we don't, it's not that we will decide these questions neutrally. It's that markets will decide these questions for us, as they have been doing for the past three decades.
And I go back to a quote of yours at the very top of the show, which is that what happens as markets control them is, in a society where everything is for sale, life is harder for those of modest means. The more money can buy, the more affluence matters. That's the 99 and the 1. You've been so successful. In other words, there you were. You come into a university, and your course becomes the most popular. You experiment with putting it online. You experiment with taking it to the countries. Very successful. People want debate. They want this. What are your – I mean, I'm pressing you just one more time on – you. I mean, you think deeply about these things. What do you think are some of the ways that we can actually – invigorate and resuscitate the public discussion that seems so lacking?
Well, I think that ideally the political parties should do this, but they're never going to do it unless we as citizens demand it. And that means there's a role for the media. There's a responsibility that higher education has to equip students with the ability and the desire to reason together in public about hard moral questions. If we don't, and this is lying in the background, and it goes back to your initial question, Terrence, what happens is not only does money buy more and more, as we're seeing, but we increasingly, the affluent and those less well-to-do, increasingly live separate lives.
Yeah.
I call it the skyboxification of American life.
Yeah.
And that, what's corroded there ultimately, is democracy, because there are fewer and fewer occasions, as money buys more and more, and as the affluent buy their way out of public institutions, fewer and fewer occasions when men and women from different backgrounds, different walks of life, encounter one another in the ordinary course of life. And we need that. Democracy doesn't require perfect equality, but it does require that we inhabit common spaces, because that's what enables us to negotiate our differences and abide them, to contend with one another, and ultimately to think of ourselves as engaged in a common project, a shared project, as citizens. So the ultimate toll that rampant marketization takes is on, I think, the civic infrastructure of democratic life. And that, I think, is what we need to try to rebuild.
And to give, to throw an economic expression, that's a price too high to pay.
I think so.
Again, the book is What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. You can learn more at justiceharvard.org. And in fact, you can take Michael Sandel's course on justice for free at that website. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. Finally, thank you to Michael Sandel. Keep up the good work.